Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now commencing the study of the book of Esther, everybody's favorite book, especially if you're a young Christian woman. We will entitle the first chapter, The Persian King Xerxes and His Queen Vashti. Let me give you some introduction to the book. This is from the NIV Study Bible. God's name is not mentioned once in the book. An interesting little factoid. The lack of God's name is true only of the Hebrew text, however, because the Septuagint does add the name of God at Esther 2:20. For so Mordecai had charged her to fear God. So it's in the Septuagint, but it's not in the Hebrew. And this has caused controversy for centuries. Some have said that Esther shouldn't be in the canon because of this. Well, as the NIV Study Bible points out, the absence of the name of God doesn't mean a tootling thing. God's presence is everywhere in the book. For example, Mordecai says that the Jews' deliverance would come from another place in Esther 4:14. That's referring to God, another place. Esther requests a fast 2 verses later in Esther 4:16. A fast? Well, that would imply prayer to God if a Jewish woman is requesting a fast. The Jews refuse to plunder their enemies in chapter 9. This shows they are fighting for the Lord, not for themselves. In addition, the book shows an incredible set of fortuitous, quote-unquote fortuitous, circumstances which led to the Jews' deliverance. These events show that God was providentially in control. Let me give you 4 examples. 1, Esther was selected to become queen from many, many virgins, not to mention the fact that it was strange that one queen was deposed, as we'll see here in chapter 1. Another fortuitous, but actually providential, event, Mordecai accidentally, quote-unquote, discovered the plot against Xerxes. God helped him to discover that plot. Esther defied a law which should have gotten her killed, but she wasn't. Mordecai was given Haman's position of power, which he used to deliver the Jews. All of this shows God's providence in saving his chosen people. Now, here are some possible explanations of why God was not mentioned in the book. It could be that the author was using a literary device of understatement. For example, when Mordecai says that deliverance was coming from another place in chapter 4:16, that, of course, is understatement because another place is talking about God or God's heaven. It could be that the author was trying not to get the book destroyed by the Persian government, as the NIV Study Bible suggests. Persia might not like the idea of God interfering with the plans of their divine monarch. So there's reasons why God's not mentioned here, and it doesn't make any difference at all that he wasn't mentioned. Now, who was the author? He was a devout Jew, obviously. Some people say Mordecai, some people say Ezra, some people say Nehemiah. We don't know. Why was the book written? It was to show how the festival of Purim, the festival of Lots, was established, and it was also to show that God protects the Jews. Where was the book written? It was written in Persia, where the setting was. Of course, Ezra and Nehemiah worked in Persia for the Persian king, or Xerxes. When was the book written? Well, I've got 2 conservative opinions. One is gotquestions.org. Their opinion is it was written between 460 and 350. And Bible.org says it was written between 539 and 333. So we see basically it was written during the times of the Persian Empire. We don't know exactly when. Now, let me give you a timeline to give you some background for this book. Cyrus's decree allowing the Jews to go back to Jerusalem after Cyrus beat the Babylonians. That decree was around 539. The Jews returned under Zerubbabel in 538. And then the Battle of Marathon happened under the Persian king Darius I, in which the Persians got beaten at a very famous battle. That was in 490. And then Darius rules from 521 to 486, and then Xerxes I takes over in 486, and of course that's the Ahasuerus in this book, so he's very important in our book here. So Xerxes I, Ahasuerus, rules from 486 to 465. Ahasuerus is the Hebrew name for Xerxes. Esther's reign starts in the 3rd year after Xerxes took over, so that's about 483 BC, and then after Xerxes dies in 465, his son Artaxerxes I reigns from 465 to 424. And then Ezra, under Artaxerxes I, returns to Israel, goes to Israel in 458 BC. That's the 2nd return of Jews to Jerusalem. And then the 3rd return to Jerusalem was under Nehemiah, still under Artaxerxes I at 445, 444. So you see, all the events of Ezra and Nehemiah took place after what took place in Esther's reign, and Esther's reign took place right around famous Greco-Persian battles. The Battle of Marathon was in 490. Hephaestus' reign begins in 483. I didn't mention this. In 480 was the famous Battle of Salamis, where Xerxes got to sit on the banks of the Bay of Salamis and watch his great Persian fleet get massacred by the Greeks. That was in 480. Then he got beat again, or his people did, in 479 at the Battle of Plataea. The three great Greco-Persian battles, Xerxes lost two of them, and he's the Xerxes we're talking about here in the time of Queen Esther. Now, Esther is very much like Joseph. Esther is imprisoned, but she rose to a position of power to save the Jews, just like Joseph did. So we start now in Esther 1:1. Now, it took place in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. As I said, Ahasuerus is the Hebrew name for Xerxes, as the NIV notes says. Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, ruled Persia from 486 to 465. As I said, he was the famous king that saw Persia defeated by the Greeks in the Battle of Salamis, 480 BC, followed by the Battle of Plataea in 479 BC. He was the son of Darius I, who ruled from 521 to 486. Darius I was the king when the temple was restored in 516 BC. He was also king during the famous Battle of Marathon in 490 BC between Persia and Greece. So that gives you a background. There's a lot of famous ancient Greek history here that intersects with the biblical history. He's in charge of 127 provinces. That shows that Persia was a huge, dominant military and economic power. Of course it was. We go now to Esther 1, verses 2 through 3. In those days, as King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne, which was at the citadel in Susa, in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his princes and attendants, the army officers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of his provinces being in his presence. Now, Susa is right near the confluence of the Tigris and Euphrates River, right at the head of the Persian Gulf. If you look at that junction point and then go northeast into Persia, for about 50 miles or so, you hit Susa, very famous place. Here's the NIV Study Bible's comment about Susa. Quote, the mound of ruins that were once the city of Susa are located about 150 miles north of the Persian Gulf in the southwestern Iran, an area known today as Khuzestan. About 150 miles north of the Persian Gulf, about 50 miles, maybe it's about 100 miles northeast of the confluence of the Tigris and Euphrates River. This is a very famous place. It was a residence of the Persian kings. They stayed either in Susa or Ecbatana in the summertime when it got hot. Ecbatana was in Media to the north. And of course, Babylon was further to the west in the Euphrates Tigris Valley. So Susa was one of the three big places of Persian kings. Daniel and Nehemiah lived in Susa. Daniel 8:2 says this, I looked in the vision, and while I was looking, I was in the citadel of Susa, which is in the province of Elam. Elam, of course, is a famous ancient Near Eastern country before the Persians. Jemison Fawcett Brown says about Susa, quote, the ancient palace of Susa has been recently disinterred from an incumbent mass of earth and ruins, and in that palace, which is beyond all doubt, the actual edifice referred to in this passage, there is a great hall of marble pillars. Now, if you want to see some fantastic ruins, go to the internet, look up Susa images, it's all there. And if Iran wasn't running that country, I'd be over there on an airplane to see this place, because it's probably the greatest mass of ancient ruins ever, anywhere. Beats Ephesus. Now, this banquet that's being given in the third year of his reign, that's 483, it had all kinds of people there, your typical political banquets, princes, attendants, army officers of Persia, and Media. Media is the old kingdom of Media that's in the northern Iranian plateau. Remember, Cyrus the Great conquered Media and then made the Medo-Persian Empire merely the Persian Empire. We will talk about that pretty much in detail when we get to the book of Daniel. We go now to Esther 1, verses 4 through 8. And he displayed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor of his great majesty for many days, 180 days. When these days were completed, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days for all the people who were present at the citadel in Susa, from the greatest to the least, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were hangings of fine white and violet linen held by cords of fine purple linen on silver rings and marble columns, and couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. Drinks were served in golden vessels of various kinds, and the royal wine was plentiful according to the king's bounty. The drinking was done according to the law. There was no compulsion, for so the king had given orders to each official of his household that he should do according to the desires of each person. Now, the wealth of Xerxes was displayed for 180 days. That doesn't mean they were having a banquet. He just put a bunch of conquered materials out in display in his palace so everybody could look and see what a great king he was, as Gill says, quote, Xerxes spent the early days of his reign suppressing revolts in Egypt and Babylon. This display of his acquired wealth was probably part of a victory celebration. Its length would have given Xerxes opportunity to reward his military commanders for service and to plan future campaigns. This display of wealth would also have served to impress friend and foe alike. The seven-day banquet was probably the culmination of the celebration, and it was probably 180 days plus 7 days at the end of the 180 days, not inclusive. Now, who was there? Of course, all the big shots, but also the least of the kingdom, the common people were there too. It says that in verse 5, from the greatest to the least. The banquet was held in the garden, the court of the garden. It's outside the palace, since everybody, including common people, had been invited. The banquet had to be held outside where there was room. Now, there were hangings in the garden, probably to divide off different spaces so people could eat in different spaces. The hangings were white and violet, purple and white, linen. They were attached by cords to silver rings. The cords were fine purple linen. So a picture, if you will, rings in at the top of the linen curtains, the linen being tied through those rings, and then they would be tied at the other end to silver rings, and those silver rings would be on bars, poles, just like curtain rods, and they were stretched from column to column. They drank from couches of gold and silver. I've never sat on one of those. I can't imagine what that was like. I imagine you would sleep pretty good on one of those things, maybe. On a mosaic pavement, these couches were. Porphyry was in the mosaic. Porphyry was a deep purplish-red colored stone with small crystals of feldspar. It was quarried in Egypt. Mother of pearl was in the mosaic on the floor. Mother of pearl is a hard, iridescent substance that forms the inner layer of certain mollusk shells used for making buttons and beads, etc. All of that's very glorious. Now, verse 8 says, the drinking was done according to the law. There was no compulsion. What in the world does that mean? Well, the NIV Study Bible says this. According to Persian law, guests at the king's table could drink only when the king drank. Xerxes set aside that law, giving permission for his guests to drink as much as they liked. This indicates both the extravagance and the revelry of Xerxes' banquet. John Gill says about this, force or compulsion Ahasuerus forbade. And thus with the Chinese now they force none to drink, but modestly invite them. Well, I don't know. I know Gill was writing, I think, in the 17th century, and he thought the Chinese were very modest about asking people to drink. I've been there in the 20th and 21st centuries, and I'm telling you, they don't modestly invite you to drink. They practically open up your jaws and pour the drink down your gullet. I remember one time I was at a banquet with a university official, and he kept insisting that I drink beer, and I don't like beer. Plus, I don't want to drink to excess and get drunk. And he just kept insisting, and he was drunk as a skunk. So I got some apple juice, which looks like beer, and I said, okay, I'll drink with you. I'll gambay with you all you want. And he looked at me, he says, what kind of beer is that? I said, it's apple beer. I remember fending off another Chinese drinker who had beaten me in several gambling games at table, and we were in Yinchuan out in the northwestern area of China, Muslim area, and this guy was a Muslim, and he kept beating me and telling me to drink, and I would take a little tiny sip, and he finally said, what's the matter with you? Americans don't drink wine? And I looked at him and I said, well, you're a Muslim. You're drinking wine. Why are you drinking wine? And he looked at me without blinking an eye, and he said, well, when I retire from being a high school principal, I'm going to go on a pilgrimage to Mecca, and I'm going to ask for forgiveness for my sins. Well, at any rate, with that rabbit trail, we'll go to Esther 1:9. Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the palace which belonged to King Ahasuerus. Now, Xerxes' wife, Vashti, had a name, a Persian name, that meant beautiful or excellent woman. We can assume she was excellently named. She gave a banquet for the women. And her banquet was inside. Xerxes' banquet was outside. The NIV Study Bible suggests the reason for this is that there was so much heavy drinking going on outside, Vashti felt it was degrading for the noble women to be there. That makes sense to me. Now, Gill, Clark, and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that it was the Oriental fashion to segregate the women in society, but the NIV Study Bible says, no, that's not true. It was not the Persian custom. Well, for whatever reason, she had a separate banquet on the inside in the palace. There was room in the palace. Her guest was not as many as Xerxes' guest, who had to be entertained outside in the courtyard. It was more private in the palace, not exposed to the sight of a bunch of drunken men. So we go now to Esther 1, verses 10 through 12. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mahuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zithar, and Carcass, the seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and the princes, for she was beautiful. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. Then the king became very angry, and his wrath burned within him. Now it says in verse 10, on the seventh day, that's at the end of that seven-day banquet that was already mentioned in verse 5 in Esther 1. At the end of this time, the king held a week-long banquet in the garden courtyard. So by the seventh day, everybody's getting good and drunk. It says the king was merry with wine. That's just a polite way of saying he was drunk. As John Gill says, he had been drinking the whole 7 days of the banquet. Now, these seven eunuchs who served Xerxes, they could be literal eunuchs or they could be merely an officer of the court. The word is a little ambiguous from the Hebrew, according to the NIV Study Bible. These men may or may not have been literal eunuchs. They may have just had a title that reflected their close relationship to the king. But on the other hand, they did have access to the king's harem because they're going to get Queen Vashti, and so that makes you think they were eunuchs. Minor detail. Now, in verse 11, Xerxes says he wants his Queen Vashti to wear her crown when she comes out before all of his drunken guests. That would make Vashti look even more impressive and beautiful than she already was. Now, it says the reason that Xerxes brought out Vashti in verse 11 was in order to display her beauty. He was bragging about his trophy wife in front of all his drunken friends. Verse 12, Queen Vashti refused to come. Why? Well, here's some options. One, she didn't want to be ogled by a bunch of drunken men, as the NIV Study Bible says. That makes sense to me. Now, the Jews, the rabbis, who have an inordinate imagination, say that what Xerxes was demanding here was that Vashti come out wearing nothing but her crown in her birthday suit with no clothes on. And it's no wonder that she refused. I don't believe that. I don't even think a drunken Persian king would be that stupid. That's pretty degrading. Even for himself, it would be degrading. Now, Vashti could have satisfied her vanity by going out. She could have said, well, yeah, I'm beautiful, and all these men think I'm beautiful, so I'll go out and let them whistle and ooh and ah at me. She could have done that. But apparently, she was noble enough and modest enough to keep her from doing that. She says, I'm not going to be ogled by a bunch of drunk men. I think that's the most reasonable explanation of why she didn't come out. The NIV Study Bible suggests that perhaps she had a political motive. I don't know what that would be. Maybe she wants to rebel against King Xerxes. I don't think so. I don't know of any evidence of that. The third reason she might have come out was because of her attitude. She might have been proud and contemptuous of Xerxes. Gill suggests that might be the case. Or it could have been that women were not supposed to be seen in public with men. Again, the NIV Study Bible disputes that idea. John Gill suggests that she may have feared what Xerxes might do when he sobered up. If she comes out, all of the drunken guests ooh and ah at her, and then Xerxes sober up, and he says, why did you come out here and let my people make fun of you? That's a disgrace to the monarchy. And she would have said, but you asked me to come out. And he would say, but I was drunk. You shouldn't have listened to me. Who knows? And then I think the easiest answer is she didn't want to be ogled. Now, note the implications of this, considering submissive wives obeying absurd commands of SOB husbands. When Paul says that he wants women to be submissive to their husbands, that means in normal family affairs. It does not mean in going to watch pornography or to go rob a bank or something like that. You know, if a husband asks a wife, a Christian husband asks a wife to watch pornography, the wife ought to go get her loaded pistol, cock it, point it between the husband's two lustful eyes, and threatened to pull the trigger. I would not advocate that she actually pull the trigger, but she should cock it and make it click so that the husband hears it. This is nonsense to abuse that scripture this way. And this was an absurd command here. Let's read what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says about this. It is scarcely possible for us to imagine the astonishment produced by such a refusal in a country and a court where the will of the sovereign was absolute. The assembled grandees were petrified with horror at the daring affront. Alarm for the consequences that might ensue to each of them in his own household next seized on their minds. In other words, all the women in the country might start rebelling against their husbands if this were allowed to go on. And the sounds of bacchanalian revelry were hushed into deep and anxious consultation. What punishment to inflict on the refractory queen? Now, Xerxes was genuinely angry in verse 12. He became very angry, the text says, and of course, drinking makes you more angry, or angrier. His wrath was inflamed by the wine. We go now to Esther 1, verses 13 through 15. Then the king said to the wise men who understood the times, for it was the custom of the king, so to speak, before all who knew law and justice and were close to him, Karshina, Shethar, Admetha, Tarshish, Meres, Marcena, and Memucan, the seven princes of Persia and Media who had access to the king's presence and sat in the first place in the kingdom. According to law, what is to be done with Queen Vashti, because she did not obey the command of King Ahasuerus delivered by the eunuchs? Now these wise men who were consulted were astrologers, very famous in Persian courts and Eastern courts. They knew the times. What does that mean? Well, it could mean they knew the proper time to do something. Should we attack? Should we not attack? It could be referring to history. They knew the history of what had happened in ancient times. It's a little bit ambiguous, but they were wise men. Why were there seven wise men? Well, that had become a custom arising from an historical incident. Seven princes killed the pseudo-Smertus in ancient Persian history. He's an interesting guy. And those seven princes killed him and put Darius the First, Xerxes' father, on the throne. So that's why you have seven wise men. Now, they had access to the king's presence in verse 14. They didn't have to go through all the court ritual and the rigmarole of being introduced to the king. They could just go in and say, King, I need to talk to you. They were big shots. And so Xerxes went to the top to figure out what to do with his insolent queen, Vashti. Now, it's interesting, they're all drunk, and they're going to be talking law here. Gill quotes the ancient Greek historian and geographer Strabo, who says that Persian decrees were considered more binding when the people passing those decrees were drunk. Interesting idea. It might help some of our legislation here in America. We go now to Esther 1, 16 through 18. In the presence of the king and the princes, Memucan said, Queen Vashti has wronged not only the king, but also all the princes and all the peoples who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, causing them to look with contempt on their husbands by saying, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought into his presence, but she did not come. So in other words, Memucan, speaking for the other six wise men, is saying, there's going to be a rebellion in all the women's households all over the Persian Empire if we let this go unanswered. Verse 18, Memucan continues, This day the ladies of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's conduct will speak in the same way to all the king's princes, and there will be plenty of contempt and anger. Well, now think about that. Do you really think that all the women in Persia are going to all of a sudden start disobeying their husbands because of what happened here? I don't think so. Adam Clark points out first, Vashti hadn't wronged the king. She had disobeyed only in this one particular. She did not exhibit a general pattern of conduct that showed rebellion against her husband. The one command she had disobeyed was absurd. Come out here so all my drunk friends can get a good look at you. Adam Clark says this reasoning that says that Vashti wronged Xerxes was inconsequent and false. Vashti had not generally disobeyed the king, therefore she could be no precedent for the general conduct of the Persian women. She disobeyed only in one particular, and this to serve a purpose. Memucan draws into a general consequence, and the rest came to the conclusion which he drew. Means the other six wise men, being either too drunk to be able to discern right from wrong, or too intent on reducing the women to a state of vassalage, to neglect the present favorable opportunity. In other words, they might have thought, this is a good chance to keep women under wraps. I think the women probably were pretty much under wraps already. I don't think they needed another excuse to do that. I could be wrong, but I don't think that's probably what happened. I just probably think they were too drunk to think about what they were doing.
Mamukin, the chief wise man, continues in Esther 1, verses 19 through 20. If it pleases the king, let a royal edict be issued by him, and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, so that it cannot be repealed, that Vashti may no longer come into the presence of King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her a royal position to another who is more worthy than she. When the king's edict, which he will make, is heard throughout all his kingdom, great as it is, then all women will give honor to their husbands, great and small. Now here in verse 19 is mentioned that famous law of the Persians, which says that once it's issued, it cannot be repealed. We read about that in Daniel 6:8. Now, O king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it may not be changed, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which may not be revoked. Namukin was looking out for his own safety here, because if the king changed his mind and repealed the law that divorced Vashti, and if he accepted Vashti back into his royal favor, then Vashti would be one heap mad at Namukin, and Namukin would thus be subject to Vashti's wrath. So he wants that law to be permanent that divorces Vashti from Ahasuerus. The law in verse 19 is said that Vashti may no longer come into the presence of King Ahasuerus. That means that's just a fancy way of saying she's going to be divorced. Now in verse 20, Mamukin continues, the chief wise man, when the king's edict, which he will make, is heard throughout all his kingdom, great as it is, then all women will give honor to their husbands. Well, now there's nothing wrong with giving honor to your husbands. But what Xerxes demanded of Vashti was not honorable, to make her come strutting out there in front of a bunch of drunken fools. So it seems to me like Xerxes and his counselors were covering up his dishonorable acts. They were trying to make Vashti look like a rebellious wife, which she was not. The fact of the matter was, Xerxes was a tyrannical husband. And so now here they are trying to make it look like we want our women to respect our husbands. They're trying to make it into something honorable, which it wasn't. Mamukin apparently here thinks that Vashti's quote-unquote rebellious attitude was going to spread. We go now to Esther 1, verses 21 and 22, and we will finish this chapter. This word pleased the king and the princes, and the king did as Mamukin proposed. So he sent letters to all the king's provinces, to each province according to its script, and to every people according to their language, that every man should be the master in his own house, and the one who speaks in the language of his own people. Mentions that the provinces had different scripts and different languages. That's something I didn't realize for a long time. The script is the letters that the language is written down in, and the language are the words that are spoken. When I was in China, I learned that everybody had the same script. Those crazy Chinese characters that drive Westerners crazy. Well, everybody knew the characters, but every dialect spoke different words. They pronounced the characters differently, so they had different languages, but the same script. Well, here, the provinces in Persia might have different scripts. They might have different languages. They might have both that are different. But this was an empire-wide edict that was sent out to everybody looking for a new queen. Well, actually, before they looked for a new queen, this edict was to say that every man's going to be master of his own house and the one who speaks in the languages of his own people. In other words, don't have a wife speaking her native language, Persians, if you married a foreigner. You speak the language you want to in your house. Don't speak in your wife's foreign language. To do so would make it at least appear that Persian husbands were losing authority in their own home. So every man should speak his own language in his family, not the language of his wife, if that language happened to be different. This is according to the pulpit commentary. Now, the decree said that every man should be the master in his own house, and Adam Clark, writing in the early 1800s, I think, said, both God's law and common sense taught this from the foundation of the world. Oh, I just love it how back then they could say that every man should be master in his own house was common sense. Not today, in our anti-masculine, demasculinized, hyper-feminized culture, it's not common sense anymore. No, the women have got to rule, or we got to have an equal marriage, whatever. Depends on how virulent the form of feminism is eaten into the particular marriage. But since back then it would be obvious that every man should be master in his own house, this edict is not adding anything to the custom or the laws of the Persian culture. That was already the case, that men were the master in their own house. And Vashti refusing to parade in front of a bunch of drunken nobles would not be inciting rebellion in Persian housewives. So this law was basically a sham. in my humble opinion, and I think in a lot of other people's humble opinions. However, God used it to get Esther on the throne, which we will see in our next chapter, chapter 2, verses 1 through 23, which we will entitle Mordecai Discovers a Plot After Esther is Queen. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.